Hi everyone, this is the Tech Move. There is a podcast where we're having conversations with immigrated tech talents and we're discussing everything from moving to a new country, expanding the network, getting visas, and securing investment for their startups. And today we are having our guest, Jansu Deniz Bayrak. Hi Jansu. Could you please introduce yourself and tell us more about what did you do before coming to the UK, your education, and probably more about your first job in the UK?
Yeah, of course. Hi, Anna. Hi, everyone. This is Jansu. I'm a senior partner at Bethnal Green Ventures, Europe's leading early stage tech for good VC. So I guess the first time I arrived in the UK, I mean, the very first time was when I was, I think, 20 as a tourist visiting friends, etc. here. But then I came here on a scholarship from the Open Society Foundation to study international human rights law. And my background is actually international relations and human rights law. But then having done a few stints there, namely with the Council of Europe in Strasbourg and back home in Turkey with Amnesty International, I sort of felt like the change that I would like to contribute to was very slow happening. Mm-hmm. And I'm just an impatient person by nature. So I wanted to go into something that was a bit more fast paced, I guess. And that was roughly 12 years ago now, 12, 13 years ago. So I went home from the UK and started looking for, I mean, I don't think I even thought of the jobs at the time as impact jobs, but starting looking into things that matter in my mind. And all I could find was like usually corporate CSR, like corporate social responsibility jobs, essentially. So I ended up going into tech as a founding member of a SaaS business, just because, you know, my interests and capabilities sort of aligned. Like I'm also quite design oriented, so I ended up working at like a designer marketplace sort of solution, which built something like a Shopify, I would say. Mm-hmm. And this was the second time I was, you know, joining a venture. My first entrepreneurial experience was building a community platform for skincare with one of my university friends. And funny enough, I'm no longer Mold, but it's still the biggest portal back home in Turkey. And my friend, who's actually an IP lawyer, is now fully working on that. So anyway, sorry, going on a tangent. And then through that experience, I went into early stage investment first through Startup Bootcamp's MENA program based home in Istanbul. Then I get poached to the London program, running the IoT one for early stage hardware companies. And once I arrived, I think the possibility sort of opened up. Then I was with all the knowledge I've had now, I was aware that, you know, impact investing is gaining more traction. It aligns with what I can do and what I know and want to do as a contribution. And then I met BGV, and we got to know each other over a couple of years, and then I joined the team.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be very, you know, it's you make it sounds very easy, but actually, I'm sure that it was not that easy just to move from Turkey to the UK. So yeah. Maybe can you just give more like color on this? How did you move your transition from, you know, Startup Bootcamp Turkey and then to the UK to become a member of the UK team? And then obviously mm-hmm. everything about the visa and how, which visa you're mm-hmm. staying here and how people can transit.
Sure. I'm happy to go into the details of it. And I guess, you know, we oversimplify our stories. And obviously, you know, it's my career is absolutely not like, it's not like I joined somewhere and then I just rose up the ranks. Like, and I like it like that. And I guess that comes with being a generalist, but also it comes with its challenges. So I'd always lived and studied abroad. I mean, I say always, but I essentially mm-hmm. ping-ponged across Europe a lot. But when the time comes to make the actual move, then it's much, much harder. And so what happened with me when I got the job offer from Startup Bootcamp London, I was between offers from Berlin and Barcelona as well. And this was pre-Brexit. And I thought, well, I mean, London is obviously the biggest hub and it'll give me a European passport down the line. So I'm going to go to London and then anyway, so I said yes to the offer, and it took them 6 months to get me a very straightforward tier two visa, which is the, you know, the general one you need when you, you know, like when you're just an employee. And I guess throughout that process, Tech Nation was called Tech City at the time. So we were essentially encouraged to apply for the exceptional talent visa because my profile fitted perfectly. But I got rejected. So that cost us a couple of months. And that was a surprise to me at the time. Anyway, so then I got the tier two visa. And I had to wait from February to September to be able to come and start working in the UK. So like there's definitely, you know, a period of just twiddling thumbs. It was, you know, it's not really pleasant. And also it's quite counterproductive when you think about hiring talent from abroad. I was lucky that my profile and what I know to do was super relevant, that they believed in me, they stuck with me, but I don't think that's the story of everyone who's non-EEA. Anyway, so then I moved to UK and I quickly realized that, you know, the visa is very restrictive. It means that for those of you who might not be familiar, it essentially limits you to the job that you have. And if you lose it, then you have a grace period of, is it 3 weeks, a month? I can't remember now. But essentially, like you can't leave your job because your visa depends on it.
And you can't do anything else, right? You
just have to leave the job. And it's exactly
such a constraint to the people who want to contribute to the tech ecosystem and be all out and about and help and be involved in other portfolio, like in other companies, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like you can just be an employee. You can't, I mean, you can, I think, start a company, but there are restrictions on it. I don't want to misinform anyone. By the way, like I'd written about my full experience from tier two to tier one on a lengthy LinkedIn post. Like, I saw that it sort of resonated with so many people because not a lot of people talk about, like, you know, it's easy to brush off the ugly parts and just say that, yeah, I got a job offer and I moved.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the underneath all of that, there is a lot of, you know, time and money and stress involved. Anyway, so in long story short, in the UK, I was lucky enough to build a profile that resonated better with Tech Nation. So I applied again in 2018 and I got the Exceptional Talent Visa, which is now renamed to Global Talent, is it?
Yeah.
Which
is
so,
a
yeah.
Golden visa, right? Which is a visa if you work in tech and you can be moving freely between different companies, and then you can be involved in many companies at the same time.
Yeah, essentially it gives you the chance to be self-employed or employed or, you know, like a mixture of both. It is just, I guess, alongside that visa, there comes a lot of, you know, just a sigh of relief because it allows you to experiment. And like the main argument I would make is like, this is essentially a visa for, like in air quotes, high-skilled workers. And again, it might be different for like, data scientist, for example. But for me, my skills can lend itself to many different areas of a business. So I was a chief operating officer. Now I'm essentially a senior partner at an investment firm. So like you can see that they're not really, on paper, they don't exactly match. But essentially, I'm the same person doing the job. So, but it allows me to explore the ecosystem and sort of decide on how best I, not only how best can I contribute, because, you know, that's the immigrant speak, right? Like we always have to talk about contributing, but also how do I derive, you know, professional satisfaction from my job? Like, what do I want to work on? And if I hadn't had that flexibility, then, you know, there are a lot of other countries in the world that could give me that flexibility. So I think that's the sort of narrative that gets a little forgotten. Like now countries are essentially competing for, you know, people that they want to see working in their industry. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think it's quite important to, you know, keep that in mind. What the world is, you know, the borders are opening up, even though there are like different forces at play that, you know, sometimes means high restrictions get into place. But overall, globalization, like the cat is out of the bag, essentially. So I think that's one of the important things, like where I felt more at peace with, you know, myself, because I felt like, you know, what I really wanted to do since I was quite young is now aligns with what I do on a day-to-day basis. So that was really satisfying.
To summarize, yeah, you have a different experience in technology, and then you finally, with this Tech Nation visa, you finally can manage to get it all and just continue developing as a leader, using your operation skills and investing skills, and helping others, helping companies. And so you have like much more impact on the society rather than if you just constrain on a tier two, which is like a working visa. I know that you're very active, you know, in the tech ecosystem, and I would love to ask this question about networking in a new country. How did you build your network in the UK? This is one of the most popular questions I've heard, especially for immigrants, especially for people coming to the UK to live, and there, where to find good people, how to connect with them, and what's your personal story?
Yeah, sure. I think it's an excellent story. I think even networking in your own country, I guess, is relatively hard when you're switching industries, and that's not the first time. Like I both switched industries from like NGOs to suddenly tech, and I switched different contexts. And I guess one thing I would say, I can't say it for all of UK, but in London it's really international. So first of all, like there's so many different avenues you can take, but I guess in terms of professional networking, one thing I did was I was lucky that my job meant that it was literally my job description to be talking about what we do to as many people as possible. So that there was definitely, you know, like incentive there for me to keep doing that. And we were the first co-working space we were very shortly based at Rainmaking Loft, but then we moved to Idea London, which is an old street run by Capital Enterprise.
How is it called again?
Idea London. Yeah, so it's Capital Enterprise, which is like an entrepreneurial support company run by John, who's like a really big support to anyone involved in the London tech ecosystem. Anyway, so and at the time we were there, it was a joint venture by UCL and Cisco, essentially. And so that was a place where a lot of people, you know, congregate, came together. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, there were meetups, there were, you know, I don't know, there were hackathons, et cetera, et cetera. So I started, you know, essentially first observing, you know, how things are done a little bit. So I think the first thing tip I'm going to say is like, go to a well-established co-working space and like start working there and then just start talking to people. And then I guess there comes a lot of volunteering your time for things that, you know, that you actually want to do. So I think I was very generous with my time and expertise when there was a particular sort of group of people I want to understand more about. So I would, you know, go to them, see what, not only just attending, but also trying to talk to them and seeing whether there's anything that I can do for them a little bit. You know, I think people respond quite well to that. And most of the time, those sort of, you know, events, et cetera, run on a voluntary basis. So I think people appreciate the support that they can get. And then I definitely, when I met a few people where I would call them like my professional friends, and I would ask them to introduce me to like people who they thought it would be good for me to chat to. And this was a very wide range of people. I talked to people who used to run Amnesty's tech arm, to people who were investors in, I don't know, deep tech. Like, and I got to meet a lot of different people that way. So I think, you know, asking someone to make introductions for you makes a lot of sense. And I guess if there isn't a direct ask, it's almost like a double-edged sword. Sometimes a direct ask is easier because, you know, at least, you know, I don't know, there's clarity.
Yeah.
But sometimes when it's more like, if people don't feel that pressure of, okay, so I'm meeting, I don't know, friend of X, and, you know, they're not going to ask me for a job at my organization, that also relieves the pressure a little bit. So it allows the conversation to breathe. So co-working space, ask your friends, volunteer your time. And I mean, I guess I don't know. I would say try to be approachable, but it's very hard to quantify that.
But you need to also build your brand, right? Because I know you have an excellent brand in the UK, and then everyone knows Jansu. So I think it's all about, like, you need to speak on the panels, but then in order to get to this level, you still need to have a networking. And especially when you ask a friend to introduce you to someone else, it's very tricky, because if it's an open question, some people, they just don't know. I mean, when people ask me, can you introduce me to someone else? I said, like, well, but tell me who exactly do you need? So when you have a list of people that you want to meet, that's much easier rather than just to have, well, I want to meet someone in tech. And so you're like, all in tech.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess when I have to caveat that, like, when I was having those relatively vaguer conversations, requests, that was with people where I would assume, like, I would call them my friends, you know. Mm-hmm. But if it's more like a professional relationship, then I think you need to go with a clear ask to why you need to talk to that person, because it's their time too, right? Like, everyone is really busy. So no one is, I don't think being busy is a race, but like, everyone is essentially trying to do quite a few things all at once. So it's also being respectful of other people's time as well.
I understand. I really want to ask you about the Turkish tech ecosystem, because you started your career there, and then you've been working in tech in Turkey. So what is different and what's remarkable about the Turkish ecosystem, in your opinion? What is it famous for?
Yeah, sure. So I think Turkish ecosystem's biggest asset is its people, I would say. Similar to most emerging ecosystems, the so-called emerging ecosystems, there's support, there's a lot of initiatives, there's not more now funding than when I left 5 years ago. Because at the time, I think a lot of entrepreneurs who needed serious runway needed to just be looking abroad. Now we have a bit more established funds. Mm-hmm. We have a few funds that have Turkish partners, so they have a leg in Turkey, but most operate in Europe, that have had really excellent success stories. Gaming, for example, is a area where there are more and more Turkish companies making a mark. I think our first biggest acquisition was Yemeksepeti by Delivery Hero, which is essentially Uber Eats. I remember reading about it at the time, and I remember I wanted to intern for them when I was fresh out of uni. So like, from that to them being acquired, it's like, it took them, I think, 13 or 14 years, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that, you know, if we were based somewhere else, like, that would have been such an easier journey. I think, like, now that there's a few companies that they essentially, there's some track record. So people recognize Turkish companies on their own merit, as opposed to just being a Turkish company. Mm-hmm. And know that, you know, they can do business there. So there's one thing that has been said a lot about Turkey, is that I think it's a very easy way to piss off a Turkish person is calling them Middle Eastern. Like I think very little, like very few Turkish people self-identify as Middle Eastern. Most think of themselves as European. I certainly do. I mean, I was born literally 2 kilometers away from Greece. You know, I'm from the Aegean bit of Turkey, isn't it? And so there's, like, usually Turkey is said to be like the easiest place to do business in Middle East, just because the culture and norms translate a bit better, perhaps. And we have a lot of good engineering schools, so we have quite a lot of engineering talent, which I think, you know, there's been a trend when there was a lot of, you know, immigrations, because those people just wanted to build, you know, what they deem better lives abroad. But now, because there's more opportunities home, I think some entrepreneurship is gaining more strength. I think it has always been popular, but tech entrepreneurship is now becoming a more viable option for quite a few people.
What about the Turkish founders? What, as an investor, what I need to be aware of, what is not? Every culture has different, some differences in essence.
Yeah.
So why, and then, for example, Eastern European, they're very direct, and then sometimes there is some lack of things that you can spot, and then how to deal with Turkish founders?
I think, like, obviously, you know, any generalization I'm going to make is going to be take with a lot of grain of salt, but essentially I would say the directness element is definitely there, and it's not only about entrepreneurs. Like, I, from when I first, even though like I studied and lived here before, like I, when I look at my emails from like 5 years ago, like my writing style definitely evolved, and when I read my emails from back then, I'm like, that sounds a bit curt to me now, you know? So I can see that people might have thought that I was a bit rude. So I think like there's definitely that element of, you know, and I feel like that's a bit more specific to the British culture, if I'm being honest. Like, the indirectness is quite encouraged. I mean, not only encouraged, but expected. So I think like the Turks might find that slightly confusing when they're dealing with, you know, like not being able to read those between the lines sort of thing, unless they're already used to dealing with the British way of communication, I would say. And I think like there are some Mediterranean cliches that I believe apply to quite a few of my my fellow country people, which is being a bit impatient. I don't want to say hot-headed, because, you know, like that doesn't really translate, but like having just wanting to push things quite fast and like expecting to push things quite fast. And finally, like perhaps, you know, looking for shortcuts, I think is something that is, I would claim, slightly ingrained in the Turkish mindset. So, and I think sometimes people find it a bit cheeky, but, you know, being pragmatic about opportunities is the diplomatic way of putting it.
Okay, that's very interesting. I want as well, like, just to touch base on your work at BGV and impact investing. And so what do you think will be the next, like, tech trends, you know, in the impact investing space? Mm-hmm. And then what would you say?
Sure. So at BGV, we have we carved ourselves niche under impact investing, that is tech for good. And the way we define tech for good is tech and tech enabled products and services that are built to be inclusive and affordable, with an intention to positively impact millions of lives. And I guess we like to stick to our, like, we like to stick to tech for good, because impact investment, as it becomes more popular, is also becoming a bit, you know, the definition of it is a bit blurred, which is fine, I guess. You know, there is an opportunity there, and more people are recognizing it. But essentially, if you can't measure your impact, then I don't think you can claim your impact. So impact measurement is becoming more and more prominent in those conversations. And it is still, unfortunately, an art more than a science. Mm-hmm. I recently completed a course on it at Oxford University, who kindly offered me a scholarship to do so, on impact measurement. And having gone through that, I'm definitely more informed on it. But is it much more clear in my head? Definitely not. And I think I should beat around drum a little bit. Like, BGV is definitely recognized as one of the, you know, in terms of impact measurement and transparency around that, as one of the world class examples of that. And like our impact reports are usually, you know, used as an example of how to do it right. So I think that gives us great pleasure. But it's really interesting, because I remember when I first joined BGV, the internal conversations we were having were always around, are we doing enough? And then you go and start benchmarking yourself against what's already out there. And it's in its infancy still. So when you do even a little, then that it suddenly puts you up a bit. And I guess we were able to build on it quite fast and in a meaningful way. So I think I'm hoping that that's going to act as an example for others to sort of follow suit. In terms of, I think you So impact measurement, obviously not as a tech trend, but like I think that's going to be a bigger part of the conversation. In terms of the trends we've seen, obviously, you know, sustainability and climate crisis are of top mind, and there's more and more push towards that. Mm-hmm. ESG is a very hot topic in VC right now. I mean, I personally believe we are already at the stage where we need ESG plus. So BGV was the UK's first VC to have become a B Corp in 2015, well ahead of the wave now, but now more and more VCs are becoming B Corps, which is excellent. And I guess in following that way, in one thing I'm personally very interested in is actually financial resilience, or maybe fintech for good, for want of a better term. So this is an area where we are very, very keen to see more more solutions in, and like an area that where we would love to do more investments in. So we are now trying to see what we can do to sort of help encourage that sort of deal flow. And, you know, what can we do? Like, what stops people from building those? More companies are sort of helping build people's financial, at least information skills. Mm-hmm. But beyond, you know, becoming a lender, like what can we do to help support people's financial resilience is really, really interesting for us. And as part of that that sort of stream, we invest in what we call worker tech ventures, which are solutions to improve diversity in the working force and help benefit low-wage workers. And I think that really goes hand in hand with financial resilience.
Okay. One of the last questions, I promise. So what about like BGV? If I'm an entrepreneur and I'm like doing tech for good, mm-hmm. and I'm very aligned with the BGV investment thesis, mm-hmm. how much I can expect to get from BGV, and mm-hmm. which stage I need to go
sure.
I need to go for money for?
Sure. So BGV has a very specific way of investing. So I guess when we meet founders that are already a bit further down the line, then there's a chance that that might be too late for us. I'll explain that in a minute. So essentially, BGV's roots come from what we call social innovation camps, which were hackathon-like events post the 2008 crisis, where tech talent and policymakers came together to like prototype solutions to societal problems. Mm-hmm. So our roots are very much experimentation driven. And then we sort of we pulled a tiny amount of capital from the cabinet office and started running programs to help both providing like those start of capital to people who want to build their own companies and allow them to experiment through an essentially an accelerator program, I would say. We call it our Tech for Good program. So that's, and then in 2012, we started, you know, investing through our first fund. And I guess we iterated that program for 17 or 18 times now. And the way we love to invest is meeting people who are at, like even for early stage, they are very early, so pre-seed. They made their homework in the sense that, you know, so we like things that are not built in a bubble. So we like things where people, you know, try and understand the need and whether their intervention makes sense. So at that stage, we give them, so this is probably going to change, but not by much. Currently, we give them 30K in cash, and then they go through the program, which is 3 plus 9 months. Then BGV can lead their pre-seed and seed rounds. And, you know, that is roughly perhaps up to 750K for seed rounds, I would say. And then we can be minority investors in Series A and B to, you know, mainly to keep our stake. But, you know, it's essentially we only, for later stages, currently we only invest in the portfolio that have gone through the program. So more often than not, I meet quite a lot of brilliant people who are sort of, you know, who wouldn't be able to take that mm-hmm. sort of dilution because they already have investors yeah. on board. That then we have to say, Ray, like, we're very pleased to have met you, but, you know, we're probably not a match for what you need. Interestingly, though, we see even in the time, so I've been at BGV for roughly 3 years now. We've seen later and later stage founders apply to BGV because they're very drawn by the brand and the community. So I would really encourage any founder, and I'm not really talking about BGV here, but if you're looking at a program or anything that where you feel like there is a certain amount of equity at stake, you should definitely be looking at not only the cash on the table, but what benefits that might bring you. Is it networks? Is it brand? Is it their ability to actually follow on into your venture? Is it the type of support that they can provide? And do your homework, talk to people who've done it. Like, we're very lucky in the sense that we invested in over 140 companies to date. Wow. And I would say more than almost all of them, like I was going to say more than majority, but almost all of them speak quite highly of BGV. So I think that's that makes our lives a bit easier when people start, you know, thinking about whether or not BGV is right for them.
Okay, interesting. And the first 30K, is are you taking a particular stake in the company?
Yeah, currently we're taking 7% for that.
Okay.
And usually we invest like right before they have an MVP or when they have an MVP. So almost always no revenue at all. So our risk appetite is very high, even compared to with other venture capitalists, I would say.
Okay. Let's, before we go back to work, like just to summarize, your top three networking tips for immigrated tech talents.
Okay. Co-working space. I mean, obviously I know COVID and everything, but you know, co-working space. Talk. talk to other immigrants, definitely. And, you know, sometimes misery loves company, but usually, you know, everyone will bring their own unique experience and networks into that. And be generous with your time, particularly when you first start just establishing yourself in a country.
Great. Thank you so much, Kansu, for being generous with your time today. And we speak later on.
Thanks for having me, Anna. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. And that's it for the Tech Move today. Thank you for listening to the Tech Move. If you were enjoying the episode, subscribe and leave us a review wherever you are listening to the podcast.